body spasming. The gate burst open. The clockwork creature spilled through into the drive, led by the one who had torn the chain apart, his skin-stripped hands gleaming in the moonlight. Remembering what Will had said, that one had to have Shadow Hunter blood to open the door, Tessa reached for the bell pull that hung beside it and yanked it hard, but heard no sound. Desperate, she whirled back to Jem, still crouched on the ground. Jem, please, you have to open the door. He raised his head. His eyes were open, but there was no color to them. They were all white, like marbles. She could see the moon reflected in them. Jem! He tried to rise to his feet, but his knees gave out. He slumped to the ground, blood running from the corners of his mouth. The cane had rolled from his hand, almost to Tessa's feet. The creatures had reached the foot of the steps. They began to surge upward, lurching a little, the one with the skinned hands in the lead. Tessa flung herself against the doors of the Institute, pounding her fists against the oak. She could hear the hollow reverberations of her blows echoing on the other side, and despaired. The Institute was so huge, and there was no time. At last she gave up. Turning away from the door, she was horrified to see that the leader of the creatures had reached Jem. It was bending over him, its skinned metal hands on his chest. With a cry, she seized up Jem's cane and brandished it. "Get away from him!" she cried. The creature straightened up, and in the moonlight, for the first time, she saw its face clearly. It was smooth, almost featureless, only indentations where the eyes and mouth should have been, and no nose. It raised its skinned hands. They were stained dark with Jem's blood. Jem himself lay very still, his shirt torn, blood pooling blackly around him. As Tessa stared in horror, the clockwork man wiggled his bloody fingers at her in a sort of grotesque parody of a wave, then turned and sprang away down the steps, almost scuttling like a spider. He dashed through the gates and was lost to view. Tessa moved toward Jem, but the other automatons moved swiftly to block her way. They were all as blank-faced as their leader, a matching set of faceless warriors, as if there had not quite been time to finish them. With a whir-click, a pair of metal hands reached for her, and she swung the cane, almost blindly. It connected with the side of a clockwork man's head. She felt the impact of wood against metal ringing up her arm, and he staggered to the side, but only for a moment. His head whipped back around with incredible speed. She swung again, the cane slamming against his shoulder this time. He lurched, but other hands flashed out, seizing the cane, yanking it from her grasp with such force that the skin of her hand burned. She remembered the painful strength of Miranda's grip on her, as the automaton who had snatched the cane from her brought it down across his knee with stunning force. It snapped in half with an awful sound. Tessa whirled to run, but metal hands clamped down on her shoulders, yanking her back. She struggled to pull free. And the doors of the Institute burst open. The light that poured from them blinded her momentarily, and she could see nothing but the outline of dark figures, ringed in light, spilling from the church's interior. Something whistled by her head, grazing her cheek. There was the grinding sound of metal on metal, and then the clockwork creature's arms relaxed, and she fell forward onto the steps, choking. Tessa looked up. Charlotte stood above her, her face pale and set, a sharp metal disc in one hand. Another matching disc was buried in the chest of the mechanical man who had held her. He was twisting and spasming in a circle like a malfunctioning toy. Blue sparks flew from the gash in his neck. Around him, the rest of the creatures were spinning and lurching as the Shadow Hunters converged on them, Henry bringing his Seraph blade down in an arc, slicing open the chest of one of the automatons, sending it reeling and jerking into the shadows. Beside him was Will, swinging what looked like a sort of scythe over and over, chopping another of the creatures to bits with such fury that it sent up a fountain of blue sparks. Charlotte, darting down the steps, threw the second of her discs. It sheared through the head of a metal monster with a sickening noise. He crumpled to the ground, leaking more sparks and black oil. The remaining two creatures, seeming to think better of the situation, turned and sprang toward the gates. Henry darted after them with Charlotte on his heels, but Will, dropping his weapon, turned and raced back toward the steps. "What happened?" he shouted at Tessa. She stared, too dazed to answer. His voice rose, tinged with furious panic. "Are you hurt? Where's Jem?"
"I'm not hurt," she whispered. "But Jem, he collapsed. There."
She pointed to where Jem lay, crumpled in the shadows beside the door.
Will's face went blank, like a slate wiped clean of chalk.
Without looking at her again, he raced up the steps and dropped down by Jem, saying something in a low voice. When there was no reply, Will raised his head, shouting for Thomas to come help him carry Jem, and shouting something else, something Tessa couldn't make out through her dizziness. Perhaps he was shouting at her. Perhaps he thought this was all her fault. If she hadn't grown so angry, if she hadn't run away and made Jem follow her. A dark shadow loomed in the lit doorway. It was Thomas, tousle-haired and serious, who went without a word to kneel down by Will. Together they lifted Jem to his feet, an arm slung around each of their shoulders. They hurried inside without a backward glance. Dazed, Tessa looked out over the courtyard. Something was strange, different. It was the sudden silence after all the clamor and noise. The destroyed clockwork creatures lay in shattered pieces about the courtyard. The ground was slick with viscous fluid. The gates hung open, and the moon shone blankly down on everything just as it had shone down on her and Jem on the bridge when he had told her that she was human. 15. Foreign Mud. Ah, God, that love were as a flower or flame, that life were as the naming of a name, that death were not more pitiful than desire, that these things were not one thing and the same. Algernon Charles Swinburne, Las Veneras. "Miss Tessa?" The voice was Sophie's. Tessa turned and saw her framed in the doorway, a lantern swinging from her hand. "Are you all right?" Tessa felt pitifully grateful to see the other girl. She had been feeling so alone. "I'm not hurt. Henry has gone after the creatures, though, and Charlotte..." "They'll be just fine." Sophie put a hand on Tessa's elbow. "Come, let's get you inside, miss. You're bleeding."
"I am?"
Puzzled, Tessa put her fingers up to touch her forehead. They came away stained red. "I must have struck my head when I fell against the steps. I didn't even feel it." "Shock," Sophie said calmly. And Tessa thought how many times in her employment here Sophie must have done these things. Bandaged up cuts, wiped away blood. "Come along, and I'll get a compress for your head." Tessa nodded. With a last glance over her shoulder at the destruction in the courtyard, she let Sophie guide her back inside the institute. The next short while was something of a blur. After Sophie helped her upstairs and into an armchair in the drawing room, she bustled off and returned moments later with Agatha, who pressed a cup of something hot into Tessa's hand. Tessa knew what it was the moment she smelled it. Brandy and water. She thought of Nate and hesitated, but once she'd had a few mouthfuls, things began to swim back into focus. Charlotte and Henry returned, bringing with them the smell of metal and fighting. Tight-lipped, Charlotte set her weapons down on a table and called for Will. He didn't respond, but Thomas did, hurrying down the corridor, his coat stained with blood, to tell her that Will was with Jem and that Jem was going to be all right. "The creatures injured him and he lost some blood," Thomas said, running a hand through his tangled brown hair. He looked at Sophie as he said it. "But Will gave him an Eratzi."
"And his medicine?" Sophie asked quickly. "Has he had some of that?"
Thomas nodded,
and the tight set of Sophie's shoulders relaxed just a bit. Charlotte's gaze softened as well.
"Thank you, Thomas," she said.
"Perhaps you can see if he requires anything else?"
Thomas nodded and set off back down the corridor with a last glance over his shoulder at Sophie, who did not seem to notice.
Charlotte sank down onto the ottoman opposite Tessa.
"Tessa, can you tell us what happened?"
Clutching the cup, her fingers cold despite its heat, Tessa shuddered.
"Did you catch the ones that escaped? The whatever they are? The metal monsters?"
Charlotte shook her head gravely.
"We pursued them through the streets, but they disappeared once we reached Hungerford Bridge. Henry thinks there was some magic involved."
"Or secret tunnel," Henry said. "I did also suggest a secret tunnel, my dear."
He looked at Tessa. His friendly face was streaked with blood and oil, his brightly striped waistcoat slashed and torn. He looked like a schoolboy who'd been in a bad scrape of some sort.
"Did you see them coming out of a tunnel, perhaps, Miss Gray?"
"No," Tessa said, her voice half a whisper. To clear her throat, she took another sip of the drink Agatha had given her, and set the cup down before running through it all. The bridge, the coachman, the chase, the words the creature had spoken, the way they had burst through the Institute gates. Charlotte listened with a pinched white face. Even Henry looked grim. Sophie, sitting quietly on a chair, attended to the story with the grave intensity of a schoolgirl. "They said it was a declaration of war," Tessa finished. "That they were coming to wreak revenge on us. On you, I suppose, for what happened to De Quincey."
"And the creature referred to him as the Magister?"
Charlotte asked. Tessa pressed her lips together firmly to keep them from trembling.
"Yes, he said the Magister wanted me and that he had been sent to retrieve me."
"Charlotte, this is my fault. If it weren't for me, De Quincey wouldn't have sent those creatures tonight, and Jem..." She looked down at her hands.
"Maybe you should just let him have me."
Charlotte was shaking her head.
"Tessa, you heard De Quincey last night. He hates shadow hunters. He would strike at the clave regardless of you. And if we gave you to him, all we would be doing is placing a potentially valuable weapon in his hands."
She looked at Henry.
"I wonder why he waited this long. Why not come for Tessa when she was out with Jesse? Unlike demons, these clockwork creatures can go out during the day."
"They can," said Henry. "But not without alarming the populace, not yet. They don't look enough like ordinary human beings to pass without exciting comment."
He took a shining gear from his pocket and held it up.
"I examined the remains of the automatons down in the courtyard. These ones De Quincey sent after Tessa on the bridge are not like the one in the crypt. They are more sophisticated, made of tougher metals, and with a more advanced jointure. Someone's been working on the design in those blueprints Will found, refining it. The creatures are faster now and deadlier."
"But how refined?"
"There was a spell," Tessa said quickly, "on the blueprint. Magnus deciphered it."
"The binding spell, meant to tie a demon energy to an automaton." Charlotte looked at Henry.
"Did De Quincey
succeed in performing it?"
Henry shook his head.
"No. Those creatures are simply configured to follow a pattern like music boxes. But they are not animate. They do not have intelligence or will or life. And there is nothing demonic about them."
Charlotte exhaled in relief.
"We must find De Quincey before he succeeds in his goal. Those creatures are difficult enough to kill as it is. The angel knows how many of them he's made or how difficult they'd be to kill if they had the cunning of demons."
"An army born neither of heaven nor hell," said Tessa softly.
"Exactly," said Henry. "De Quincey must be found and stopped. And in the meantime, Tessa, you must stay in the Institute. Not that we want to keep you a prisoner here, but it would be safer if you remained inside."
"But for how long?"
Tessa began, and broke off as Sophie's expression changed. She was looking at something over Tessa's shoulder, her hazel eyes suddenly wide. Tessa followed her gaze. It was Will. He stood in the doorway of the drawing room.
There was a streak of blood across his white shirt. It looked like paint. His face was still, almost mask-like, his gaze fixed on Tessa. As their eyes met across the room, she felt the pulse jump in her throat.
"He wants to talk to you," Will said.
There was a moment of silence as everyone in the drawing room looked at him. There was something forbidding about the intensity of Will's gaze, the tension of his stillness. Sophie had her hand at her throat, her fingers nervously fluttering at her collar.
"Will," Charlotte said finally, "do you mean Jem? Is he all right?"
"He's awake and talking," Will said. His gaze slid momentarily to Sophie, who had glanced down as if to hide her expression. "And now he wants to speak to Tessa."
"But..."
Tessa looked towards Charlotte, who seemed troubled.
"Is he all right? Is he well enough?"
Will's expression didn't change.
"He wants to talk to you," he said, enunciating each word very clearly. "So you will get up, and you will come with me, and you will talk to him. Do you understand?"
"Will!"
Charlotte began sharply, but Tessa was already rising, smoothing down her rumpled skirts with the flat of her hands. Charlotte looked worriedly at her, but said nothing more. Will was utterly silent as they made their way down the corridor, witchlight sconces throwing their shadows against the far walls in spindly patterns. There was blackish oil as well as blood splattered on his white shirt, smudging his cheek. His hair was tangled, his jaw set. She wondered if he had slept at all since dawn, when she had left him in the attic. She wanted to ask him, but everything about him, his posture, his silence, the set of his shoulders, said that no questions would be welcome. He pushed open the door of Jem's room and ushered her in ahead of him. The only light in the room came from the window and from a taper of witch light on the bedside table. Jem lay half under the covers of the high carved bed. He was as white as his nightshirt, the lids of his closed eyes dark blue. Leaning against the side of the bed was his jade-headed cane. Somehow it had been repaired and was whole again, gleaming as if new. Jem turned his face toward the sound of the door, not opening his eyes.
"Will?"
Will did something then that amazed Tessa. He forced his face into a smile and said in a passably cheerful tone,
"I brought her, like you asked."
Jem's eyes flicked open. Tessa was relieved to see that they had returned to their usual color. Still, they had the look of shadowed holes in his pale face.
"Tessa," he said, "I'm so sorry."
Tessa looked at Will for permission or guidance, she wasn't sure, but he was staring straight ahead. Clearly he would be no help. Without another glance at him, she hurried across the room and sank down in the chair by the side of Jem's bed.
"Jem," she said in a low voice, "you shouldn't be sorry or be apologizing to me. I should be the one apologizing. You didn't do anything wrong. I was the target of those clockwork things, not you."
She patted the coverlet gently, wanting to touch his hand but not daring to.
"If it wasn't for me, you never would have been hurt."
"Hurt," Jem spoke the word on an exhale of breath, almost with disgust.
"I wasn't hurt."
"James."
Will's tone held a warning note.
"She should know, William. Otherwise she'll think this was all her fault."
"You were ill," Will said, not looking at Tessa as he spoke.
"It's nobody's fault."
He paused.
"I just think you should be careful. You're not well still. Talking will just tire you out."
"There are more important things than being careful."
Jem struggled to sit up, the cords in his neck straining as he lifted himself, propping his back against the pillows. When he spoke again, he was slightly breathless.
"If you don't like it, Will, you don't have to stay."
Tessa heard the door open and close behind her with a soft click.
She knew without looking that Will had gone. She couldn't help it. A slight pang went through her, the way it always seemed to do when he left a room. Jem sighed. He's so stubborn. He was right, Tessa said. At least he was right that you don't need to tell me anything you don't want to. I know none of it was your fault. Fault has nothing to do with it, Jem said. I just think you might as well have the truth. Concealing it rarely helps anything. He looked toward the door for a moment as if his words were half meant for the absent Will. Then he sighed again, raking his hands through his hair. You know, he said, that for most of my life I lived in Shanghai with my parents, that I was raised in the institute there. Yes, Tessa said, wondering if he was still a little dazed. You told me on the bridge, and you told me that a demon had killed your parents. Yan Luo, said Jem. There was hatred in his voice. The demon had a grudge against my mother. She'd been responsible for the death of a number of its demon offspring. They'd had a nest in a small town called Lijiang, where they'd been feeding on local children. She burned the nest out and escaped before the demon found her. Yan Luo bided its time for years. Greater demons live forever, but it never forgot. When I was 11, Yan Luo found a weak spot in the ward that protected the institute and tunneled inside. The demon killed the guards and took my family prisoner, binding us all to chairs in the great room of the house. Then it went to work. Yan Luo tortured me in front of my parents, Jem went on, his voice empty. Over and over it injected me with a burning demon poison that scorched my veins and tore at my mind. For 2 days I went in and out of hallucinations and dreams. I saw the world drowned in rivers of blood, and I heard the screams of all the dead and dying throughout history. I saw London burning and great metal creatures striding here and there like huge spiders. He caught his breath. He was very pale, his nightshirt stuck to his chest with sweat, but he waved away Tessa's expression of concern. Every few hours I would come back to reality long enough to hear my parents screaming for me. Then on the second day I came back and heard only my mother. My father had been silenced. My mother's voice was raw and cracked, but she was still saying my name. Not my name in English, but the name she had given me when I was born, Jian. I can still hear her sometimes, calling out for me. His hands were tied on the pillow he held, tight enough that the fabric had begun to tear. Jem, Tessa said softly, you can stop. You needn't tell me all of it now. You remember when I said that Mortmain had probably made his money smuggling opium? He asked. The British bring opium into China by the ton. They have made a nation of addicts out of us. In Chinese, we call it foreign mud or black smoke. In some ways, Shanghai, my city, is built on opium. It wouldn't exist as it does without it. The city is full of dens where hollow-eyed men starve to death because all they want is the drug, more of the drug. They'll give anything for it. I used to despise men like that. I couldn't understand how they were so weak. He took a deep breath. By the time the Shanghai enclave became worried at the silence from the institute and broke in to save us, both my parents were already dead. I don't remember any of it. I was screaming and delirious. They took me to the Silent Brothers, who healed my body as well as they could. There was one thing they couldn't fix, though. I had become addicted to the substance the demon had poisoned me with. My body was dependent on it the way an opium addict's body is dependent on a drug. They tried to wean me off it, but going without it caused terrible pain. Even when they were able to block the pain with warlock spells, the lack of the drug pushed my body to the brink of death. After weeks of experimentation, they decided there was nothing to be done. I could not live without the drug. The drug itself meant a slow death, but to take me off it would mean a very quick one. Weeks of experimentation? Tessa echoed. When you were only 11 years old? That seems cruel.
Goodness, real goodness, has its own sort of cruelty to it, said Jem, looking past her. There, beside you on the bedside table, is a box. Can you give it to me?
Tessa lifted the box. It was made of silver, its lid inlaid with an enamel scene that depicted a slim woman in white robes, barefoot, pouring water out of a vase into a stream.
Who is she? She asked, handing the box to Jem.
Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy and compassion. They say she hears every prayer and every cry of suffering and does what she can to answer it. I thought perhaps if I kept the cause of my suffering in a box with her image on it, it might make that suffering a little less. He flicked open the clasp on the box and the lid slid back. Inside was a thick layer of what Tessa thought at first was ash, but the color was too bright. It was a layer of thick silvery powder, almost the same bright silver color as Jem's eyes.
This is the drug, he said.
It comes from a warlock dealer we know in Limehouse. I take some of it every day. It's why I look so ghostly. It's what drains the color from my eyes and hair, even my skin. I wonder sometimes if my parents would even recognize me. His voice trailed off. If I have to fight, I take more. Taking less weakens me. I had taken none today before we went out to the bridge. That's why I collapsed. Not because of the clockwork creatures, because of the drug. Without any in my system, the fighting, the running, was too much for me. My body started feeding on itself, and I collapsed. He shut the box with a snap and handed it back to Tessa.
Here, put it back where it was.
You don't need any?
No, I've had enough tonight.
You said that the drug meant a slow death, Tessa said. So do you mean the drug is killing you? Jem nodded, strands of bright hair falling across his forehead. Tessa felt her heart skip a painful beat. And when you fight, you take more of it? So why don't you stop fighting? Will and the others would understand, Jem finished for her. I know they would. But there is more to life than not dying. I am a shadow hunter. It is what I am, not just what I do. I can't live without it.
You mean you don't want to?
Will, Tessa thought, would have been angry if she'd said that to him. But Jem just looked at her intently.
I mean I don't want to.
For a long time I searched for a cure, but eventually I stopped and asked Will and the rest to stop as well. I am not this drug or its hold on me. I believe that I am better than that, that my life is about more than that, however and whenever it might end.
Well, I don't want you to die, Tessa said. I don't know why I feel it so strongly, I've just met you, but I don't want you to die.
And I trust you, he said. I don't know why, I've just met you, but I do. His hands were no longer clutching the pillow, but lying flat and still on the tasseled surface. They were thin hands, the knuckles just slightly too big for the rest of them, the fingers tapering and slender, a thick white scar running across the back of his right thumb. Tessa wanted to slide her own hand over his, wanted to hold his tightly and comfort him.
Well, this is all very touching.
It was Will, of course, having come soundlessly into the room. He had changed his bloody shirt, and he seemed to have washed up hastily. His hair looked damp, his face scrubbed, though the crescents of his nails were still black with dirt and oil. He looked from Jem to Tessa, his face carefully blank.
I see that you told her.
I did. There was nothing challenging in Jem's tone. He never looked at Will with anything but affection, Tessa thought, no matter how provoking Will was. It's done. There's no more need for you to fret about it.
I disagree, said Will. He gave Tessa a pointed look. She remembered what he had said about not tiring Jem out and rose from her chair.
Jem gave her a wistful look. Must you go? I was rather hoping you'd stay and be a ministering angel, but if you must go, you must.
I'll stay,
Will said a bit crossly and threw himself down in the armchair Tessa had just vacated. I can minister angelically. None too convincingly. And you're not as pretty to look at as Tessa is, Jem said, closing his eyes as he leaned back against the pillow.
How rude.
Many who've gazed upon me have compared the experience to gazing at the radiance of the sun. Jem still had his eyes closed. If they mean it gives you a headache, they aren't wrong.
Besides, Will said, his eyes on Tessa, it's hardly fair to keep Tessa from her brother. She hasn't had a chance to look in on him since this morning.
That's true. Jem's eyes fluttered open for a moment. They were silvery black, dark with sleep. My apologies, Tessa. I nearly forgot. Tessa said nothing. She was too busy being horrified that Jem wasn't the only one who had nearly forgotten about her brother. It's all right, she wanted to say, but Jem's eyes were shut again and she thought he might be asleep. As she watched, Will leaned forward and drew up the blankets covering Jem's chest. Tessa turned around and let herself out as quietly as she could. The light in the corridors was burning low, or perhaps it had simply been brighter in Jem's room. Tessa stood for a moment, blinking, before her eyes adjusted. She gave a start. Sophie? The other girl was a series of pale smudges in the dimness, her pale face and the white cap dangling from her hand by one of its ties. Sophie, Tessa said, is something wrong? Is he all right? Sophie demanded, a strange small hitch in her voice. Is he going to be all right? Too startled to make sense of her question, Tessa said, who? Sophie stared at her, her eyes mutely tragic. Jem. Not Master Jem or Mr. Carstairs. Jem. Tessa looked at her in utter astonishment, suddenly remembering. It's all right to love someone who doesn't love you back, as long as they're worth you loving them, as long as they deserve it. Of course, Tessa thought. I'm so stupid. It's Jem she's in love with. He's fine, she said as gently as she could. He's resting, but he was sitting up and talking. He'll be quite recovered soon, I'm sure. Perhaps if you wanted to see him... No, Sophie exclaimed at once. No, that wouldn't be right or proper. Her eyes were shining. I'm much obliged to you, miss. She turned then and hurried away down the corridor. Tessa looked after her, troubled and perplexed. How could she not have seen it earlier? How could she have been so blind? How strange to have the power to literally transform yourself into other people and yet be so unable to put yourself in their place. The door to Nate's room was slightly ajar. Tessa pushed it open the rest of the way as quietly as she could and peered inside. Her brother was a heaped mound of blankets. The light from the guttering candle on the bedside table illuminated the fair hair spread across his pillow. His eyes were closed, his chest rising and falling regularly. In the armchair beside the bed sat Jessamine. She too was asleep. Her blonde hair was coming out of its carefully arranged chignon, the curls tumbling down onto her shoulders. Someone had thrown a heavy woolen blanket over her, and her hands clutched it, drawing it up against her chest. She looked younger than Tessa had ever seen her look, and vulnerable. There was nothing about her of the girl who had slaughtered the fairy in the park. It was so odd, Tessa thought, what brought out tenderness in people. It was never what you would have expected. As quietly as she could, she turned away, shutting the door behind her. Tessa slept fitfully that night, waking often amid dreams of clockwork creatures coming for her, reaching out their spindly metal-jointed hands to catch and tear at her skin. Eventually that dissolved into a dream of Jem, who lay asleep in a bed while silver powder rained down on him, burning where it struck the coverlet he lay under, until eventually the whole bed burned, and Jem slept peacefully on, oblivious to Tessa's warning cries. Finally she dreamed of Will, standing at the apex of the dome of St. Paul's, alone under the light of a white, white moon. He wore a black frock coat, and the marks on his skin were plain to be seen on his neck and hands under the glow of the sky. He looked down on London like a bad angel pledged to save the city from its own worst dreams, while below him London slept on, indifferent and unknowing. Tessa was torn from her dream by a voice in her ear and a hand vigorously shaking her shoulder.
Miss!
It was Sophie, her voice sharp.
Miss Gray, you simply must wake. It's your brother.
Tessa shot upright, scattering pillows. Afternoon light poured through the bedroom windows, illuminating the room, and Sophie's anxious face.
Nate's awake? He's all right?
I don't know, miss.
There was a little catch in Sophie's voice.
You see, he's gone missing.
16. The Binding Spell. And once or twice to throw the dice is a gentlemanly game. But he does not win who plays with sin in the secret house of shame. Oscar Wilde, The Ballad of Reading Gaol.
Jessamine, Jessamine, what's going on? Where's Nate?
Jessamine, who was standing just outside Nate's room, whirled to face Tessa as she hurried up the corridor. Jessamine's eyes were red-rimmed and her expression angry. Loose curls of blonde hair were coming out of the usually neatly arranged knot at the back of her head.
"I don't know," she snapped. "I fell asleep in the chair beside the bed, and when I woke up, he was gone, just gone."
She narrowed her eyes.
"Gracious, you look ghastly."
Tessa glanced down at herself. She hadn't bothered with a crinoline or even shoes. She'd just thrown on a dress and slid her bare feet into slippers. Her hair was straggling down around her shoulders, and she imagined she likely resembled the madwoman Mr. Rochester kept in his attic in Jane Eyre.
"Well, Nate can't have gone very far, not as ill as he is," Tessa said.
"Isn't anyone looking for him?"
Jessamine threw up her hands. "Everyone's looking for him. Will, Charlotte, Henry, Thomas, even Agatha. I don't suppose you want us to roust poor Jem out of bed and make him part of the search party, too?"
Tessa shook her head. "Honestly, Jessamine," she broke off, turning away.
"Well, I'm going to look as well.
You can stay here if you like."
"I do like."
Jessamine tossed her head as Tessa spun away and stalked off down the corridor, her mind whirling.
Where on earth could Nate have gone? Had he been feverish, delirious?
Had he gotten out of bed not knowing where he was and staggered off to look for her? The thought made her heart clench. The Institute was a baffling maze, she thought as she turned yet another blind corner into yet another tapestry-lined corridor. If she could barely find her way around it even now, how could Nate possibly?
Miss Gray?
Tessa turned and saw Thomas emerging from one of the doors along the hall. He was in shirt sleeves, his hair tousled as usual, his brown eyes very serious. She felt herself go very still.
Oh, God, it's bad news.
Yes?
I found your brother, Thomas said, to Tessa's astonishment.
You have? But where was he?
In the drawing room. Got himself a bit of a hiding place behind the curtains he had.
Thomas spoke hastily, looking sheepish.
Minute he saw me, he went right off his chump, started screaming and yelling. Tried to bolt right past me, and I nearly had to give him one over the gash to keep him quiet.
At Tessa's look of incomprehension, Thomas paused and cleared his throat.
That is to say, I'm afraid I may have frightened him, miss.
Tessa put her hand over her mouth.
Oh, dear, but he's all right.
It seemed that Thomas did not know quite where to look. He was embarrassed to have found Nate cowering behind Charlotte's curtains, Tessa thought, and she felt a wave of indignation on Nate's behalf. Her brother wasn't a shadow hunter. He hadn't grown up killing things and risking his life. Of course he was terrified. And he was probably delirious with fever on top of that.
I had better go in and see him. Just me, you understand? I think he needs to see a familiar face.
Thomas looked relieved.
Yes, miss, and I'll wait out here just for now.
You just let me know when you want me to summon the others.
Tessa nodded and moved past Thomas to push the door open. The drawing room was dim, the only illumination the gray afternoon light that spilled through the tall windows. In the shadows, the sofas and armchairs scattered about the room looked like crouched beasts. In one of the larger armchairs by the fire sat Nate. He had found the blood-stained shirt and trousers he'd been wearing at De Quincey's and had put them on. His feet were bare. He sat with his elbows on his knees, his face in his hands. He looked wretched.
"Nate," Tessa said softly.
At that, he looked up and sprang to his feet, a look of incredulous happiness on his face.
"Tessie!"
With a little cry, Tessa rushed across the room and threw her arms around her brother, hugging him fiercely. She heard him give a little whimper of pain, but his arms went around her, too, and for a moment, embracing him, Tessa was back in her aunt's little kitchen in New York, with the smell of cooking all around her and her aunt's soft laughter as she scolded them for making so much noise. Nate pulled away first and looked down at her.
"God, Tessa, you look so different."
A shudder went through her.
"What do you mean?"
He patted her cheek almost absently.
"Older," he said. "Thinner. You were a round-faced little girl when I left New York, weren't you? Or is that just the way I remember you?"
Tessa reassured her brother that she was still the same little sister he'd always known, but her mind was only partly engaged with his question. She couldn't help staring at him worriedly. He no longer looked as gray as he had, but he was still pale, and bruises stood out in blue, black, and yellow patches on his face and neck.
"Nate." "It's not as bad as it looks," he said, reading the anxiety on her face.
"Yes, it is. You should be in bed, resting. What are you doing in here?"
"I was trying to find you. I knew you were here. I saw you before that bald bastard with the missing eyes got at me. I figured they'd imprisoned you, too. I was going to try to get us out."
"Imprisoned? Nate, no, it's not like that." She shook her head. "We're safe here."
He narrowed his eyes at her.
"This is the Institute, isn't it? I was warned about this place. De Quincey said it was run by madmen, monsters who call themselves Nephilim. He said they keep the damned souls of men penned up in some kind of a box of theirs, screaming."
"What? The Pyxis?
It holds bits of demon energy, Nate, not men's souls.
It's perfectly harmless. I'll show it to you later, in the weapons room, if you don't believe me."
Nate looked no less grim. He said that if the Nephilim got their hands on me, they'd take me apart, piece by piece, for breaking their laws. A cold shiver went up Tessa's spine. She drew away from her brother and saw that one of the drawing-room windows was open, the curtains fluttering in the breeze. So her shiver had been more than just nerves.
"Did you open the window? It's so cold in here, Nate."
Nate shook his head.
"It was open when I came in."
Shaking her head, Tessa went across the room and drew the window down.
"You'll catch your death."
"Never mind my death," Nate said irritably. "What about the Shadow Hunters? Are you saying they haven't kept you imprisoned here?"
"No," Tessa turned away from the window. "They haven't. They're strange people, but the Shadow Hunters have been kind to me. I wanted to stay here. They've been generous enough to let me."
Nate shook his head.
"I don't understand."
Tessa felt a spark of anger, which surprised her. She pushed it back.
"It wasn't Nate's fault.
There was so much he didn't know."
"Where else was I going to go, Nate?"
she asked, crossing the room to him and taking his arm. She led him back over to the armchair.
"Sit down. You're exhausting yourself."
Nate sat obediently and looked up at her. There was a distant look in his eyes. Tessa knew that look. It meant he was plotting, hatching some mad plan, dreaming a ridiculous dream.
"We can still get away from this place," he said. "Get to Liverpool, get on a steamer, go back to New York."
"And do what?" Tessa said as gently as she could.
"There's nothing there for us, not with Aunt dead. I had to sell all our things to pay for the funeral. The apartment's gone, there was no rent money. There's no place for us in New York, Nate."
"We'll make a place, a new life."
Tessa looked at her brother sadly. There was pain in seeing him like this, his face full of hopeless pleading. bruises blossoming on his cheekbones like ugly flowers, his fair hair still matted in places with blood. Nate was not like other people, Aunt Harriet had always said. He had a beautiful innocence about him that had to be protected at all costs. And Tessa had tried. She and her aunt had hidden Nate's own weaknesses from him, the consequences of his own flaws and failings, never telling him of the work Aunt Harriet had had to do to make up the money he had lost gambling, of the taunts Tessa had endured from other children calling her brother a drunk, a wastrel. They had hidden these things from him to keep him from being hurt. But he had been hurt anyway, Tessa thought. Maybe Jem was right. Maybe the truth was always best. Sitting down on the ottoman opposite her brother, she looked at him steadily. It can't be like that, Nate. Not yet. This mess we're both in now, it will follow us even if we run. And if we run, we'll be alone when it does find us. There will be no one to help or protect us. We need the Institute, Nate. We need the Nephilim. Nate's blue eyes were dazed. I guess so, he said, and the phrase struck Tessa, who had heard nothing but British voices for nearly 2 months, as so American that she felt homesick. It's because of me that you're here. De Quincey tortured me, made me write those letters, send you that ticket. He told me he wouldn't hurt you once he had you, but then he never let me see you, and I thought, he raised his head and looked at her dully. You ought to hate me. Tessa's voice was firm. I could never hate you. You're my brother. You're my blood. Do you think when all this is over we can go back home? Nate asked. Forget all this ever happened. Live normal lives. Live normal lives. The words conjured up an image of herself and Nate in some small, sunny apartment. Nate could get another job, and in the evening she could cook and clean for him, while on weekends they could walk in the park or take the train to Coney Island and ride the carousel, or go to the top of the Iron Tower and watch the fireworks explode at night over the Manhattan Beach Hotel. There would be real sunshine, not like this gray, watery version of summer. And Tessa could be an ordinary girl, with her head in a book and her feet planted firmly on the familiar pavement of New York City. But when she tried to hold this mental picture in her head, the vision seemed to crumble and fall away from her, like a cobweb when you tried to lift it whole in your hands. She saw Will's face, and Jem's, and Charlotte's, and even Magnus's as he said, "Poor thing. Now that you know the truth, you can never go back." "But we are not normal," said Tessa. "I am not normal." "And you know that, Nate." He looked down at the floor. "I know." He gave a helpless little wave of his hand. "So it's true. You are what De Quincey said you were. Magical. He said you had the power to change shape, Tessie, to become anything you wanted to be." "Did you even believe him?" "It's true. Well, almost true. But I barely believed it myself at first. It's so strange."
"I've seen stranger things." His voice was hollow. "God, it ought to have been me."
Tessa frowned. "What do you mean?" But before he could answer, the door swung open.
"Miss Gray," it was Thomas looking apologetic, "Miss Gray, Master Will is..." "Master Will is right here." It was Will ducking nimbly around Thomas despite the other boy's bulk. He was still in the clothes he'd changed into the night before, and they looked rumpled. Tessa wondered if he'd slept in the chair in Jem's room. There were blue-gray shadows under his eyes, and he looked tired, though his eyes brightened. With relief? Amusement? Tessa couldn't tell, as his gaze fell on Nate.
"Our wanderer found at last," he said. "Thomas tells me you were hiding behind the curtains."
Nate looked at Will dully. "Who are you?" Quickly, Tessa made the introductions, though neither boy seemed all that happy to meet the other. Nate still looked as if he were dying, and Will was regarding Nate as if he were a new scientific discovery, and not a very attractive one at that.
"So you're a shadow hunter," Nate said. "De Quincey told me that you lot were monsters. Was that before or after he tried to eat you?" Will inquired.
Tessa rose quickly to her feet.
Will, might I speak to you in the corridor for a moment, please?
If she had expected resistance, she didn't get it. After a last hostile look at Nate, Will nodded and went with her silently out into the hall, closing the drawing-room door behind him. The illumination in the windowless corridor was variable, the witchlight casting discreet bright pools of light that didn't quite touch one another. Will and Tessa stood in the shadows between two of the pools, looking at each other. Warily, Tessa thought, like angry cats circling in an alley. It was Will who broke the silence.
Very well. You have me alone in the corridor.
Yes, yes, said Tessa impatiently. And thousands of women all over England would pay handsomely for the privilege of such an opportunity. Can we put aside the display of your wit for a moment? This is important.
You want me to apologize, do you? Will said, for what happened in the attic.
Tessa, caught off guard, blinked. The attic?
You want me to say that I'm sorry that I kissed you?
At the words, the memory rose up again in Tessa with such unexpected clarity. Will's fingers in her hair, the touch of his hand on her glove, his mouth on hers. She felt herself flush and hoped furiously that it wouldn't be visible in the dimness.
What? No, no.
So you don't want me to be sorry, Will said. He was smiling very slightly now, the sort of smile a small child might bend upon the castle he has just built out of toy blocks, before he destroys it with a wave of his arm.
I don't care whether you're sorry or not. Tessa said. That's not what I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to tell you to be kind to my brother. He's been through an awful ordeal. He doesn't need to be interrogated like some sort of criminal. Will replied more quietly than Tessa would have thought.
I understand that. But if he's hiding anything...
Everyone hides things, Tessa burst out, surprising herself. There are things I know he's ashamed of, but that doesn't mean they need to matter to you. It's not as if you tell everyone everything, do you?
Will looked wary. What are you on about?
What about your parents, Will? Why did you refuse to see them? Why do you have nowhere to go but here? And why, in the attic, did you send me away?
But Tessa said none of those things.
Instead, she said, What about Jem? Why didn't you tell me he was ill the way he is?
Jem? Will's surprise seemed genuine. He didn't want me to. He considers it his business, which it is. You might recall I wasn't even in favor of him telling you himself. He thought he owed you an explanation, but he didn't. Jem owes nothing to anyone. What happened to him wasn't his fault, and yet he carries the burden of it and is ashamed.
He has nothing to be ashamed of.
You might think so. Others see no difference between his illness and his addiction, and they despise him for being weak. As if he could just stop taking the drug if he had enough willpower.
Will sounded surprisingly bitter.
They've said as much, sometimes to his face. I didn't want him to have to hear you say it, too.
I would never have said that.
How would I have guessed what you might say?
Will said.
I don't really know you, Tessa, do I? Any more than you know me.
You don't want anyone to know you, Tessa snapped. And very well, I won't try, but don't pretend that Jem is just like you. Perhaps he'd rather people knew the truth of who he is.
Don't, Will said, his blue eyes darkening. Don't think you know Jem better than I do.
If you care about him so much, why aren't you doing anything to help him? Why not look for a cure? Do you think we haven't? Do you think Charlotte hasn't looked, Henry hasn't looked, that we haven't hired warlocks, paid for information, called in favors? Do you imagine Jem's death is just something we've all accepted without ever fighting against it?
Jem told me that he had asked you all to stop looking, Tessa said, calm in the face of his anger. And that you had. Haven't you?
He told you that, did he?
Have you stopped?
There is nothing to find, Tessa. There is no cure.
You don't know that. You could keep looking and not ever tell him you were looking. There might be something, even the littlest chance.
Will raised his eyebrows. The flickering corridor light deepened the shadows under his eyes, the angular bones of his cheeks.
You think we should disregard his wishes?
I think that you should do whatever you can, even if it means you must lie to him. I think I don't understand your acceptance of his death. and I think that you do not understand that sometimes the only choice is between acceptance and madness. Behind them in the corridor, someone cleared their throat.
What's going on here, then? Asked a familiar voice.
Both Tessa and Will had been so caught up in their conversation that they had not heard Jem approaching. Will gave a guilty start before turning to look at his friend, who was regarding them both with calm interest. Jem was fully dressed, but looked as if he had just woken from a feverish sleep, his hair mussed and his cheeks burning with color. Will looked surprised and not entirely pleased to see him.
"What are you doing out of bed?"
"I ran into Charlotte in the hall. She said we were all meeting in the drawing room to talk with Tessa's brother." Jem's tone was mild, and it was impossible to tell from his expression how much of Tessa and Will's conversation he had overheard.
"I'm well enough to listen, at least."
"Oh, good, you're all here." It was Charlotte hurrying up the corridor. Behind her strode Henry, and on either side of him, Jessamine and Sophie. Jessie had changed into one of her nicest dresses, Tessa observed, a sheer blue muslin, and she was carrying a folded blanket. Sophie, beside her, held a tray with tea and sandwiches on it.
"Are those for Nate?" Tessa asked, surprised. "The tea and the blankets?"
Sophie nodded.
"Mrs. Bramwell thought he'd likely be hungry, and I thought he might be cold. He was shivering so last night,"
Jessamine put in eagerly.
"Should we bring these things into him, then?"
Charlotte looked at Tessa for her approval, which disarmed her. Charlotte would be kind to Nate. She couldn't help it.
"Yes, he's waiting for you."
"Thank you, Tessa," Charlotte said softly, and then she pushed the drawing room door open and went in, followed by the others. As Tessa moved to go after them, she felt a hand on her arm, a touch so light she almost might not have noticed it. It was Jem.
"Wait," he said. "Just a moment."
She turned to look at him. Through the open doorway she could hear a murmur of voices. Henry's friendly baritone, Jessamine's eager falsetto rising as she said Nate's name.
"What is it?"
He hesitated. His hand on her arm was cool. His fingers felt like thin stems of glass against her skin. She wondered if the skin over the bones of his cheeks, where he was flushed and feverish, would be warmer to the touch.
"But my sister," Nate's voice floated into the hallway, sounding anxious.
"Is she joining us? Where is she?"
"Never mind, it's nothing." With a reassuring smile, Jem dropped his hand. Tessa wondered, but turned and went into the drawing room, Jem behind her. Sophie was kneeling by the grate, building up the fire. Nate was still in the armchair, where he sat with Jessamine's blanket thrown over his lap. Jessamine, upright on a stool nearby, was beaming proudly. Henry and Charlotte sat on the sofa opposite Nate, Charlotte clearly bursting with curiosity, and Will, as usual, was holding up the nearest wall by leaning against it and looking both irritable and amused at the same time. As Jem went to join Will, Tessa fixed her attention on her brother. Some of the tension had gone out of him when she'd come back into the room, but he still looked miserable. He was plucking at Jessamine's blanket with his fingertips. She crossed the room and sank down onto the ottoman at his feet, resisting the urge to ruffle his hair or pat his shoulder. She could feel all the eyes in the room on her. Everyone was watching her and her brother, and she could have heard a pin drop.
"Nate," she said softly. "I assume everyone has introduced themselves?"
Nate, still picking at the blanket, nodded.
"Mr. Gray," said Charlotte. "We have spoken to Mr. Mortmain already. He has told us a great deal about you, about your fondness for Downworld, and gambling."
"Charlotte," Tessa protested. Nate spoke heavily.
"It's true, Tessie. No one blames your brother for what happened, Tessa."
Charlotte made her voice very gentle as she turned back to Nate.
"Mortmain says you already knew he was involved in occult practices when you arrived in London. How did you know that he was a member of the Pandemonium Club?"
Nate hesitated.
"Mr. Gray, we simply need to understand what happened to you. De Quincey's interest in you...
I know you aren't well, and we have no wish to cruelly interrogate you, but if you could offer us even a little information, it might be of the most invaluable assistance.
It was Aunt Harriet's sewing notions, Nate said in a low voice.
Tessa blinked. It was what?
Nate continued in a low voice. Our Aunt Harriet always kept Mother's old jewelry box on the nightstand.